listening to a speech given by journalist Elizabeth Colbert, given on April 16, 2006, and sponsored by WGBH in Boston. You can find this and many other fine speeches at forum.wgbh.org, part 2 of 2.
Now, the story that I've told up to this point is, in many ways, as I said before, a classic narrative of scientific triumph. People made discoveries. Some of these discoveries were actually inadvertent, and other people built on them. And eventually, the theory and the evidence lined up, and the truth will out. And we now spend hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps billions, actually, a year on climate research. And in fact, there may well be more people working on studying global warming right here in the Boston area today than there were scientists of any sort in John Tyndall's day. But at the same time, if what you focus on is not the progress of science as an isolated intellectual exercise, but the role of science in a modern society, then it's a pretty devastating tale of failure. And I actually talked to Charles David Keeling, who was the man who discovered how to measure CO2 about a year and a half ago. And as it turned out, this was just a few months before his death. And he told me that by the mid-1960s, by the time that trend line was clear, we basically knew all we needed to know that we needed to take action. Now, obviously, that did not happen. And if you look at trends here in the U.S., which is supposedly the world's most technologically advanced nation, since the Charney Panel report was issued in 1975, then for all intents and purposes, all of the studies and expeditions and model runs might as well not have existed. And here's a chart of fuel efficiency of the average new passenger vehicle sold in this country. And I'm sorry that the bottom is cut off, but there should be time across the bottom, and it's starting in the 1970s. And you can see that fuel efficiency was increasing rapidly after the oil shocks of the 1970s. And then what happened? Well, we all know what happened. SUVs, which are here are light trucks, were introduced. And in 1985, SUVs accounted for only 2% of new vehicles sold in the U.S., and today they account for nearly 25%. And the average new vehicle sold today weighs nearly 4,100 pounds, which is up from 3,200 pounds in the early 1980s. So fuel efficiency of the average new passenger vehicle peaked in the mid-80s, and since then it has actually declined slightly. And just the other day, the Times had a big article, front page article, about fuel efficiency, and the headline of it was, "Car makers use new technology to beef up muscle, not mileage." And meanwhile, the average size of a newly constructed home went from 1,500 square feet in 1970 to 2,349 square feet in 2004. And not surprisingly, given these trends, CO2 in the emissions in the U.S. have been rising from 5.8 billion metric tons in 1980 to 6.8 billion metric tons last year. Now, meanwhile, global warming, once a prospective concern when the Charney report came out, is now something that is palpably affecting people's lives. And this is a slide of one of the very first places that I went to visit on my tour of what you might call global warming hotspots. And it's an Inupiat village called Shishmaref, and it sits on a tiny island off the Seward Peninsula. And archaeological records show that it has been inhabited, at least on a seasonal basis, for several centuries. And Shishmaref used to be protected from fall storms by sea ice, which acted sort of the way a tarp would on a pool, and it prevented the surface of the water from getting roiled up when these big fall storms come in. And now the sea ice comes in so late that the island just gets pummeled by these storms. This picture was taken after one of these storms, but to be frank, that house is probably gone by now. And the whole island is just being eaten away. And a couple of years ago, the people of Shishmaref voted to move the whole village onto the mainland. But this is an extremely expensive proposition. It's estimated it would cost $180 million to move this village in a part of the world where they're the only way to move anything around is by bush plane. So for the time being, they are actually still there. And this next slide, that shows what has happened to the perennial Arctic sea ice, which is the Arctic sea ice that persists year-round, so it's there summer and winter. And this shows you how it has been shrinking in recent years. And there on the left, you see the extent of the Arctic sea ice at the end of the 1979 melt season. And the melt season lasts basically through September. And these images come from satellite data, government satellite data. And on the right is from the end of the 2005 melt season, so just a few months ago. And the 2005 season was a record melt. And the extent of the sea ice was the smallest ever recorded. And the loss in just this time, just this quarter of a century, amounts to 500,000 square miles, or as it is often pointed out for polemical purposes, an area twice the size of Texas. Now, this loss is symptomatic of global warming, but it is also a cause of global warming, and this leads to the whole issue of feedbacks. Ice, particularly sea ice, is very clean and very white, and it has a highly reflective surface. And it reflects something like 80 or 90% of the sunlight that hits it. And this has a huge effect on the climate because that energy is being reflected. It is not being absorbed. But if you convert that ice to water, water is an extremely bad reflector, it's an extremely good absorber, and it just soaks up that energy. And that causes more melt, which leads to more heat absorption and so on. And there are now estimates that there will be no perennial Arctic sea ice by the year 2050. Okay, so that's not a very long time from now. And this feedback, what's called the ice albedo feedback, is one of the reasons that the Arctic is heating up more quickly than the rest of the planet. And I just included this, I just added this recently, because I got an email from someone in Shishmaref. I've sort of kept in touch with them. And the heading on the email, or the title on the email, was Greetings from Balmy Shishmaref. And you may not be able to read that title up there, but it says open water up to the beach in February. So basically, the sea ice just didn't come in this year. And that is something that really no one can remember ever having happened. And that, to be honest, probably hasn't happened in thousands of years. Now, another impact of warming that you're starting to see is thawing permafrost. And I took a ride through the interior of Alaska with a permafrost expert named Vladimir Romanovsky. And we started out in Fairbanks, which is sort of south central Alaska and is built on a region of discontinuous permafrost. And that means that parts of the area have permafrost under them and parts don't. And all permafrost is ground that has been frozen for two successive years. That's the definition. And when permafrost starts to thaw, and a lot of it around the Fairbanks area is thawing, it can just basically give way, like a floorboard that has rotted. And the hole on the left is what's called a thermokarst. That's a result of thawing permafrost. And curiously enough, that one opened up right on the campus of the University of Alaska. And on this other picture is of what's called a drunken forest. And when the ground starts to thaw, you also have in Alaska this phenomenon of ice wedges, which were formed during the last glaciation, these huge wedges of ice that have remained frozen basically for tens of thousands of years, and they are now starting to melt. And the trees that have been growing on top of them just basically fall over. And everyone in Alaska has seen these forests, and that's the effect that you get. And Romanovsky and I took a trip through interior Alaska checking on his permafrost monitoring stations. And this is just a picture of the route we took. It's actually the highway that was built for the Alaskan oil pipeline. It's a spectacular place. And like melting sea ice, thawing permafrost is both a symptom of global warming and also potentially a cause of more of it. Because the permafrost is so cold, really by definition frozen, the plants that grow on top of it do not fully decompose when they die. So there's a tremendous amount of stored carbon in the permafrost. If you dig into the permafrost, in some places you can find vegetation that is still green after tens of thousands of years. Now, by some estimates, there's as much as 450 billion metric tons of carbon stored in the permafrost. And when that permafrost starts to warm up, the carbon that is stored in it is likely to be released into the air, either in the form of CO2 or, if conditions are wet, in the form of methane, which is an even more powerful greenhouse gas. And Romanofsky put it to me this way, it's like a ready-use mix, just a little heat, and it will start cooking. Now, this slide is from another spectacular place I got to visit, which is the town of Ilulissat on the western coast of Greenland. And Ilulissat sits on Disko Bay next to a fast-moving ice stream called the Jakobshafen Isbray. And you can see ice streams are sometimes hard to picture in your mind, but you have to realize that ice is always flowing. It's flowing like water, only a lot more slowly. And this gives you a sense of what an ice stream looks like. That's the Jakobshafen Isbray shot from the air, and this is also shot from the air, but up closer. And the Jakobshafen Isbray pushes these enormous icebergs that you saw a couple seconds ago out into Disko Bay, and it's likely that the iceberg that sank the Titanic followed that route. And it's a bit of a tourist spot, or at least as much of a tourist spot as any place so difficult to get to can be. And people come to Ilulissat, mainly European tourists, to be honest, because the icebergs are a thrilling sight, a reminder of the immensity of nature and the smallness of man. But recently, they have really started to acquire a different meaning. People who live in Ilulissat will tell you that the icebergs have gotten smaller and that they break up more easily. And this anecdotal information is confirmed by satellite measurements and also by measurements taken by the Global Positioning System stations out on the ice sheet. And what these measurements show is that the ice stream is moving faster, that its height is dropping, and that its calving front, this is a diagram of the calving front, which is where the ice stream basically calves off these icebergs, is moving farther and farther inland. And that slide shows you that's 2001 and to 2004, and it shows you how fast this is happening. And that's a distance of several miles that the calving front has moved inland. And the concern here is that the Jakobshafen Isbray dumps a tremendous amount of ice into the North Atlantic, a tremendous amount of fresh water. And as it accelerates, that amount increases. It's very strange the last few years, and a Ilulissat town councilman told me you can see a lot of strange changes. Now, all of the places that I've mentioned so far are in the Arctic, and that is no coincidence. A lot of the impacts of global warming are most noticeable in the far north, where, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at things, very few people tend to live or even visit. And this effect is sometimes called the polar amplification, and it was also predicted by early climate models. So what about here, closer to home? Well, here in New England, the changes have been more subtle, but they are definitely measurable at this point. Spring flowering dates here in Boston have advanced by about a week. Frogs are mating earlier, the date of the first fall frost is later, snow cover is declining, we certainly saw that this winter when we had almost no snow, and we get more of our rainfall in these very heavy precipitation events of more than 2 inches in 24 hours. And all of these effects were also predicted. And another predicted effect of global warming is more intense hurricanes, which we certainly seem to have seen this past year. 2005 broke just about every hurricane record you can name. Normally, there are 3 or 4 Category 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic over the course of a whole decade. Last year, there were 3 in 1 year, Katrina, Rita, and Wilma. And Wilma, at one point, had the lowest central pressure of any hurricane ever recorded. And a study published just before Rita showed that the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes has, in fact, nearly doubled in the last 30 years, while the number of Category 1 hurricanes has declined. So the proportion of storms that are very intense is going up significantly. And I went down to Louisiana not long after Rita, and I just included a few images of what I saw. I'm sure they're pretty familiar images by now. This is Plaquemines Parish, which is just south of New Orleans. And these are these two huge fishing boats. They're both 150 feet long. They're Menhaden boats. And they had been deposited across a 4-lane highway by the water. And this is a pretty self-explanatory picture of a truck in a tree. And so much evidence of a warming Earth has begun to pile up that the debate, such as it was, really had to shift. And I follow these things pretty closely, and I would say that it is, in fact, shifting. And one piece of evidence which I would cite, which may seem sort of circular, I'm sorry about that, is the reaction that I got to the pieces that I wrote. And instead of the old argument, which just basically consisted of denying that global warming was real or that it was taking place, you now get a new argument. And I'm sort of going to give you a preview because I think you're going to hear it more and more. And it goes like this. Yes, we know there's more CO2 in the air, and yes, the Earth is getting warmer. But who knows what the relationship is? And just, in fact, just the other day at one of the many press conferences he held recently, President Bush said, and this is a quote, "The globe is warming. The fundamental debate, is it man-made or natural?" Now, as I hope I have impressed upon you, this argument really ignores more than 100 years of research, from Arrhenius to the Charney Panel to James Hansen. And the changes that we are now seeing in the world actually represent a textbook example of the predictive powers of modern science. But this argument is often championed in the name of scientific rigor. And the argument often goes on to observe that the climate changed before people were around and it will change again. We shouldn't get all bogged down in arguing about the causes. We should just devote our resources to dealing with the effects. And this is a quote from a recent Wall Street Journal editorial. "The problems associated with climate change, whether man-made or natural, are the same old problems of poverty, disease, and natural hazards like floods, storms, and droughts. Money spent directly on these problems is a much surer bet than trying to control a climate change process that we don't understand." Now, I mention this argument because I think it's extremely dangerous. Like most forms of sophistry, it mixes propositions that are true with propositions that sound as if they could be true, but unfortunately are not. And it is certainly the case that the climate has changed in the past for reasons that we do not entirely understand. And this graph shows you what has happened to temperatures over central Greenland. And this temperature record can be extracted from ice cores that have been drilled 2 miles into the Greenland ice sheet, and you can get the temperature by looking at the isotopic composition of the water. And this is very well agreed upon. So this is the average temperature over central Greenland going back 100,000 years, so roughly to the beginning of the last ice age. And it shows you that temperatures have, in fact, often swung wildly. And you can also see, get my laser pointer here, that this is all of human civilization fits into that tiny corner up there. So a time of unusual climate stability. And it's probably not a coincidence that that occurred. And that is something that is very sobering to think about. And the fact is that after 6 or 7 or 8,000 years of civilization, however long you'd like to call it, we do know what is causing the current climate change, or at least a very good deal of it. And what is so dangerous about the argument that we should focus on addressing the symptoms of this problem and not the causes is that this problem is cumulative. CO2 is a persistent gas. What you put up there lasts, and this is a very rough figure, but about a century. And this graph shows you various emissions scenarios. And what you're seeing on the top there is emissions, so human emissions in gigatons of carbon per year, going forward. And this is what happens correspondingly to atmospheric concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere. And those upper level scenarios are sometimes referred to as business as usual because we basically just keep doing what we're doing without regard to what we are doing to the climate. And if you follow those upper-level paths, then you can see that by the end of this century, we end up with CO2 concentrations that are not double pre-industrial levels, they are triple pre-industrial levels. And the equilibrium warming associated with those levels, so the warming needed to bring the Earth back into energy balance with space, is between 6 and 11 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you want to get a sense of what 6 to 11 degrees means, then think about this. During the last glacial maximum, when the area where we were standing was covered by nearly a mile of ice, then the average global temperature was only about 10 degrees colder than it is today. So that is an extremely large change. And Jim Hansen at NASA, whom I mentioned previously, recently warned that if we do not curb our emissions, then by the end of this century, the Earth will be committed to warming of such a degree as to constitute, quote, practically a different planet. And here, I promise, is absolutely the last graph I'm going to show you. Again, a lot of you have probably seen it. It's a very famous graph, and it's a record of temperature and CO2 concentrations taken from a core drilled at an Antarctic research station called Vostok, a Russian research station, and it was a joint American-Russian-French enterprise. And because there is less snowfall in Antarctica, the record goes back further than on Greenland. It's a less detailed record, but it goes back much further. And the Vostok record goes back 420,000 years ago, and in fact, scientists are now working on a core that will go back 700,000 years. And this graph, so that's showing you four glacial cycles. And you can see how temperature and CO2 concentrations have gone up and down in tandem for more than 400,000 years. And once again, I will use my handy pointer. That's us. We are up here, so we are off the charts, as you can see. And we are heading, if we don't do anything, up there, towards levels that probably have not been seen since the Eocene, some 50 million years ago. So if you think about this for a little while, you realize that saying, well, we don't really need to address the causes of climate change, we should just address the symptoms, is sort of comical, or it would be if it weren't so frightening. Now, I'm going to wrap up soon, and that usually means that it is time to shift gears. And I've presented you with all of the frightening figures, and now it's time for me to explain how we get ourselves out of this. How, if we pull together and turn off the lights and carpool, we can stave off disaster. But in fact, I am not going to end that way. Sorry. I am going to end with another question. And the question is, why haven't we taken global warming more seriously? And I hope that it is evident that it is not because the science is in any way equivocal. As I've tried to make absolutely clear tonight, the basic physics of global warming have been understood for more than a century now. Fully 25 years ago, all of the changes that we are now seeing all over the world were predicted by climate modelers. Any journalist or scientist or elected official who tells you that he or she remains skeptical about the connection between human activity and climate change is someone, I'm afraid, who either hasn't bothered to look at the evidence, or perhaps is on the payroll of an oil or coal company, or is simply too self-protective to face the facts. And by self-protective, I don't mean selfish in the narrow sense of someone who only cares about his or her own well-being. I really mean too sentimental, or perhaps too anxious, or perhaps too guilt-ridden to acknowledge what is really going on here, which is that we are creating enormous, quite possibly insuperable difficulties for our children and our grandchildren for what is, in the end, no very good reason. We, as Americans, lead lives of unprecedented comfort and privilege. And in the process, on an aggregate basis, we produce more carbon dioxide than any other country, and on a per capita basis, we produce more CO2 than almost any other people in the world, our only competition being the residents of some oil-producing states in the Persian Gulf. Global warming is obviously a technological problem, but it is finally also an ethical one. With knowledge comes certain responsibilities. And it is these responsibilities that we have as a society and also as individuals been running away from. Thank you.
You're listening to a speech given by journalist Elizabeth Colbert, given on April 16, 2006, and sponsored by WGBH in Boston. You can find this and many other fine speeches at forum.wgbh.org. Part 2 of 2.